So all of those factors, I think, made my tenure as development director a mixed bag. I think my greatest contributions were in cultivation. I think I built a lot of goodwill for the college among potentially important donors because my personal relationship with them were strong. So that I don't think that I was a failure, but I don't think that I did as well as I should have in fundraising.
When was it that you became the Vice President for Financial Affairs?
That was about 1973 or 4. I took on joint responsibility. I don't think it's a wise portfolio. The same person should not be in charge of both raising it and spending it, in a way, and that's what I was. I would have guessed it was around 73, 4.
74.
Yeah. Now, what happened was that I got, when I was made vice president for both, I was given staff help. Balthaser became director of development, and he was very competent in that area. He wasn't terribly good with some of our well-to-do alumni. Bill was a little bit flamboyant for them. But in terms of organizing in a professional way, he was first class. So he was good. And then I got Sam Gubins. And we needed to have someone to oversee the business operation. Because I was involved in development, and I was also had some overall responsibilities for security and all kinds of things. Needed somebody to look strictly at the business side. And so we started looking around, and one of the people who applied was Sam Gubins. He was in the accounting. He was in the economics department, as you remember. And I interviewed several people for the job, including, I remember, Tom Wood, who went to French Central School later. And I rejected Sam. I don't forget why I did, but I thought he hadn't had experience, and I thought he was pushy and so forth. He came back to me 2 days after I rejected him and said, "You made a big mistake." And he laid out the reasons. He was very, very candid in telling me that I made a big mistake. And after we talked for an hour, I decided I had made a mistake. And I took him on. I never regretted it. Sam was brash. Sam did barge into things. He sometimes acted as if he was me and I was him. But whenever I called him to account, he would always recognize that. And so we got along fine. And Sam Gubins made a far larger contribution to this college than he'd ever gotten credit for. He didn't get along with Robert, and it's partly through his own fault. He was not tactful in the way he dealt with Robert. And Robert got rid of him. And I don't blame Robert for that, but I do blame him for not giving Sam the credit that he deserved at this college. He turned the place around, I didn't. And what he did was, he saw that our whole accounting operation was absolutely 1850, maybe 1900. There was very little, and I knew this and was very upset about it. There was no relation, really, between the cost centers through which expenses were accumulated and the cost centers which were drawn up in the budget. Therefore, you could not tell where the money was going. The treasurer was Bill, and he was in Center City and working on the budget. And then you had expenses out here, and their cost centers were different. And it was really unbelievable, the lack of control of money. When I came from the Friends Service Committee to Haverford College, I had thought the service committee was fairly adequate in the way it dealt with its money. But when I got out here and found that there was absolutely no comparison between the mechanisms in this Elia Mazzanari charitable organization and the way in which Hereford accounted for its money. It were really, and of course we were losing money at that time badly every year. We never knew where it was bleeding. And so the only thing that's what Sam did was to persuade the finance committee that he had to have $30,000 to hire Coopers and Lybrand to overhaul the whole system, stem to stern, which they did. He got it, and he then developed reporting mechanisms so that by the time he got the thing really going, every department head was getting on the 15th of the month following their budget compared to their expenses, where they stood in their budget within 15 days of the ending of a month. And it was a well-functioning system. Now, he brought in Steve, what's his name? I can't remember his name now.
Theophilus?
No, that was before that. He'd fired Theophilus. It was Steve, somebody else, young guy, who was his chief accountant. And Steve was very competent and was administering the program. And the great thing that happened, unhappily, was that Robert got rid of them both at the same time and brought in Edward Revelinsky. And while it was Robert's prerogative, and the thing that was wrong was that the only two people who understood the system were both released at the same time. And you brought in Edward, who had had 1 year of business experience, who had been a professor of religion here. And he was just way, way over his head. He was a nice guy, a good fellow, but it was no favor to him. It really hurt him. He was a black, and Robert wanted more blacks in the administration, but he wasn't qualified. And the result was that a lot of the work which Sam had got going lapsed. We never lost at all. We still had our budgets, and our expenses were in the same ballpark. But the reporting was much less effective and efficient. So we lost some ground, but Sam did, through this fundamental change, control expenses, and by 1975, I think, we began to balance our budget again and turned it around. It always annoyed me that Robert claimed it was when he came and was done, but it happened before we got here that we got the thing under control. So anyway, I think Sam did a tremendous job in putting this place on a business-like basis. He's never gotten credit for it.
Well, and he's been a successful vice president for the Academy of Natural Sciences.
Yes, he has.
Ever since.
And I had lunch with him just a few, two or three days ago, and he said that he volunteered the fact that while at the time he was very unhappy that it has worked out very well for him, he think it was well for him that he left Haverford, that he's done very happy at the Academy, and so that everything's fine. But it was not terribly happy at the time.
Let's go back to Jack for a little while before we go on to Robert.
Yeah.
I have very fond memories of our Monday morning meetings in Jack's office. And I had the feeling that Jack really listened to the senior administrators on the campus in a way that Robert probably never did. And I wondered if you had that feeling.
Oh, very definitely. I have the same feeling about those Monday morning meetings. There was an opportunity for everybody to share their thinking and to get advice and counsel from the rest. I mean, we talked about so that one could bring to that gathering problems that his or her particular department had and have a discussion. Robert's style was very different. I think it's just a matter of administrative style. He didn't really like that consultative process. He wanted to deal directly with you as the librarian, for example, and he wanted to deal with the provost and the provost, and he wanted to keep all the reins in his own hands. And so it was very different. But my own feeling was that those meetings were very productive and very helpful. It helped us to know each other. It made a team out of the operation, and prevented frictions from developing. It was a style which I think was congenial with the Quaker Haverford approach to things. No one was trying to build a big power center for themselves, and it was a joyous kind of thing. The same can be said for the way in which we used to meet once a week with the heads of the student body, the president of the student council, the head of honor council, the treasurer of student council. The three would meet with me and Jack and Gerhard Spiegler, or later Tom D'Andrea, and this was...
Okay.
Those were some of the most interesting and enjoyable hours with it each week. Once a week we met with those groups, we brought them in. And we had, during that period, obviously leadership varied, but at one point where we had Barry Zubrow as the president of the council, and John M. Coleman, Jack's son, as the head of the first vice president, and I think a guy named Flowers as the second vice president, whatever it was. And those sessions where we would talk about the student gripes, what they needed, what they wanted, the exchanges between the administration and the students were really quite astonishing. Sometimes they would get what they wanted, sometimes they wouldn't. But there was a very, very, very healthy give and take. I've never known anything like it before or since here. And it was really extraordinarily useful. And it kept relations between the administration and the students on a mutually respectful basis. And I think it was one of the great contributions Jack made. I'll get into that just a little bit later. But the same thing was true of relations with the black students later on. We used to meet, when I became acting president, and I just continued, I met with the head of the black student group every week, a regular appointment. And Jack started that. And I think the relations between the student community and the administration were extremely strong at that time. It was very, very, very enjoyable.
Which was the Vietnam period.
Vietnam period, that's right. And that's exactly when it needed to be strong. Jack had his faults as president. He tended to shoot from the hip. He was very mercurial and unpredictable. He was going to have a bunch of alumni, some heavy hitters in for dinner. Why, he wouldn't be in the office for 2 days. He'd be doing shopping and cooking, and he'd be running the whole operation down there at his house. So he had his own priorities. I think probably he stayed a year or two longer than he should have in terms of his own interests and so forth. But in the earlier days of the Vietnam period, when the rest of the country was going crazy and the campuses were absolutely out of control, Jack was absolutely superb, in my view. Jack was superb. His way in which he turn the students into constructive pursuits was, and his own leadership was really extraordinary. And I think Hereford came through that period with a positive impact, not a negative one. And I give him all the credit for that.
Do you think his handling of the co-education question was as well done as it might have been?
Well, I would say that the real snag in his dealing with that was his personal relationship with Harris Wofford. He and Harris didn't like each other. They really didn't trust each other. And where you had the two presidents at somewhat a sword, rather at sword's points, obviously there was problems were exacerbated. So my answer has to be no. I don't know whose fault that breakup, probably both of them were at fault, but it certainly handicapped the process. I think that Jack, aside from that, pushed as hard as he could, and I think he dealt with the board well. The problem was, and one problem was that the board was extraordinarily edgy and jumpy about offending Bryn Mawr. A lot of the board members were married to Bryn Mawrers. We might make headway with the board on Friday afternoon at the board meeting, but they'd go home for dinner, and by the time they came out from dinner, they would be back on their old track. And the board, I think, was painfully slow. And I think we'd have done a lot better if we'd have moved faster, and Bryn Mawr would have a lot of the anguish just build up, and to the point in the late 70s where it really was some very bad feeling, and some of the alumni meetings were very acrimonious. And so the process did not go as smoothly as it should have, or could have. And part of the responsibility, in my view, lies with the board, and part lies with Jack's relationship with Harris. So that's my answer. I think that he tried and did well. I think his resignation over the issue, I think he resigned anyway. I think this was a issue which lent itself to his resignation, but I don't think that other things being equal, he would have resigned over the issue if he hadn't had other problems.
Was he getting a bit bored with being president by that time?
I guess I was just thinking about the word bored.
Restless, maybe.
Restless. I mean, his earlier vision, he saw Harris as a kind of Camelot. I mean, he really had this great vision, Hereford. And he made various proposals to the faculty, which weren't well thought through, and the faculty wouldn't buy them, and that upset him. I think he felt a certain frustration. So I think he got tired of the job. His leadership was not nearly as effective at the end as it was at the beginning.
Let's turn to the time that you were the acting president.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Did you enjoy that year?
I would be very candid in saying that my year as acting president was the happiest year of my professional life, career, of all the years since I started working after I got out of Hereford. Yes, I loved it. I should also make clear that from the very beginning, I understood that it was an interim appointment. The college made that clear when they made the appointment. I was not a candidate for partly main reason being that I thought that any candidates coming in here, if the acting president was a candidate, it put everybody at a real disadvantage, and it was best better that I not be a candidate. I think the college was absolutely on the level with me from the very beginning. And also, I would recognize that at Haverford, scholarship and proper degrees are important for a president in terms of their relations with the faculty. So that was where it began. I think the problem with my problem was that as I went through the year, I found myself more and more excited about the job, and immodestly I would say that I thought I was doing it well. I think the thing that I enjoyed the most about it was that the presidency of any institution, particularly a small one like Haverford, is what Roosevelt used to call a bully pulpit. The president has an absolutely unparalleled opportunity to articulate what the college is all about, to set a tone for the campus. At every opportunity, he meets with the faculty, he meets with the alumni, he meets with the press, he meets with the students, he has, she, whoever is the head of it, has an opportunity that no one else on the campus can have. I found that out when I was doing it. And I felt one of the main reasons I came here from the very beginning was to try to enhance the Quaker character of the college and to be able to articulate that why that was important. This was what the presidency offered. Secondly, I developed a very strong relationship with the student community. I related to the students well. I think that was returned. I felt that I handled, I had good ties with the alumni. I thought I was in a strong position with them. The great question mark was the faculty, as a non-scholar, how I would relate to them. I resolved very early that I would place heavy reliance on the provost for advice. I felt
that was Tom D'Andrea.
Tom D'Andrea. That I felt that I had a great respect for scholarship, although I certainly never laid claim to being a scholar myself. And I thought that the academic council was a source of help and advice for me during that year, which I wanted to call about. I wanted to make clear to them that their judgments were very important to me and that I never would go against them without full discussion as to why and whether I should. I was not going to be wield presidential authority. I was given to consultation of finding an answer with them, particularly on academic matters, because I didn't think I was qualified. As the year went on, I thought, obviously the first year of a president is always a honeymoon anyway, so that I never had a real chance to find out how well I would do. But as the year wore on, I found myself feeling that I had something to offer the college at a time when I felt it was more important than ever that there be a Quaker voice and that I wanted to try to do it. Well, I was approached by students about becoming a candidate, and I said I couldn't do that. I'd given my word. I couldn't do it. They went on, and you know, they were made the news, a kind of spokesperson for this, and there was no noise about it. Well, this alarmed, I think, the search committee. There was quite a feeling among some of the members that we needed a scholar. The college was slipping somewhat academically, they felt, and they needed to have a scholar to come in, a first-class scholar. So the decision was made that Robert would be appointed. And John Whitehead came down to Philadelphia and took me to dinner at the Barclay Hotel to tell me that that's what they were going to do. And I never felt that the college in any way had operated improperly. I mean, I thought they had made it very clear I was a temporary person. I didn't have any feeling that I'd been sold down the river in any way. But this is not to say that I didn't tell John that while I understood their decision, I thought the college's one distinction among liberal arts colleges was its Quaker character. And that I thought to bring in someone who knew almost nothing about Friends was placed that in jeopardy. And therefore I wanted to say that to him, although I recognized the basis for their decision and I accepted their decision. At the time, John said that he realized that